for an effective date. The Resources Committee considered the bill, recommending do pass Stevens, Chenault, McGuire, Fate, Fertula, Massack, and Scousey. The report was signed by Massack and Scousey co-chairs. The Finance Committee considered the bill, recommending do pass Bundy, Harris, Croft, Moses, Hudson, Lancaster, Mulder, Williams. The report was signed by Mulder and Williams co-chairs. I have no amendments, Mr. Speaker.
Madam Majority Leader.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that SB 77 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Without objection, we are in third reading. Would the clerk please read the title for the third and final time?
Senate Bill Number 77, entitled An Act Repealing the Exception That Applies to Collection and Payment of Interest of $150 or Less on Royalty or Net Profit Shares, Underpayments and Overpayments, and Providing for an Effective Date.
Discussion. Representative Whitaker.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. In this contest for the no-brainer of the day, I may have it. And it may have been appropriately assigned to me to speak. Draw your own conclusion, please. And then don't let me know what they are, please. Mr. Speaker, technology changes. And as technology changes, so too must the laws that technology has attached to it. AS 3805135 was a law that was specifically put in place to deal with a lack of technology. It required that underpayments and overpayments of $150 or less relating to royalty payments would be calculated manually. Well, technology is such today that it's no longer necessary to calculate manually, and therefore we should take AS 3805135 to an appropriate place and certainly not have it remain in the statute books. The bill is that simple.
Representative Whitaker. Any further discussion? Ready for the question? Question before the body. Shall SB 77 pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Would the clerk please lock the roll? Would any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk.
36 yeas, 0 nays.
And so SB 77 has passed the House. Madam Majority Leader.
I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call on the bill be considered the roll call vote on the effective date clause.
Without objection,
Mr.
the
Speaker.
Effective date clause is adopted.
Mr. Speaker, brief at ease.
Representative Sisman?
Brief at ease, please.
Brief at ease. Representative Sisman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I need to claim a conflict of interest on House Bill 204, which we just voted on.
For the record, I appreciate your putting it on the record, and I will retroactively object to your conflict of interest.
Thank you.
And verify your vote.
Verify my vote.
No, I just verified
you
your
just
vote.
You just verified so my vote. Thank
you're okay.
You.
Would the clerk please read the next item?
CS for Senate Bill 103 Finance. Entitled An Act Relating to Election Campaigns and Legislative Ethics. During second reading was returned to the Rules Committee. The Rules Committee considered the bill, recommends it be replaced with House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 103 Rules with the same title, recommending do pass Porter, Morgan, McGuire, and Cott, amend Berkowitz. The report was signed by Cott Chair. The Rules Committee considered the bill the second time, recommends it be replaced with House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 103 Second Rules with the same title, recommending do pass McGuire, Coring, Morgan, and Cott. No recommendation, Berkowitz and Jewell. The report was signed by Cott Chair. I have four committee substitutes in my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Madam Majority Leader.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the House rescind its previous action in adopting the Finance Committee Substitute for House Bill 103.
Without objection, we have rescinded our action in adopting the Finance Committee substitute. Madam Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the second Rules Committee substitute for House Bill 103 be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Without objection, we have the second Rules Committee substitute of Senate Bill 103 in front of us. Do we have amendments?
Amendment number one by Representative Halcrow to page 9, line 24.
Representative Halcrow.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would move amendment number one.
There is objection, Representative Halcrow.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm not quite sure whether this is a quote-unquote reasonable objection, and I think that's really my concern with this section of the bill. Currently, Mr. Speaker, this area is covered in two parts of the statute books, Title 15, which deals with campaign finance, and Title 24, which deals with the code of conduct that dictates what legislators and legislative employees should and should not do. Now, this section of the bill allows for a reasonable use of governmental resources to advocate, oppose, or support or oppose a constitutional amendment. Now, I'm not quite sure what reasonable means. Does reasonable mean you can use a pencil and a piece of paper to write a letter? Does reasonable mean you can use state equipment like computers, telephones, to do phone banking? Does reasonable mean if you have two staffers, you're going to use one staffer full-time to advocate for or against a particular constitutional amendment? I think that this crosses the line. And to be perfectly honest with you, Mr. Speaker, I don't have any problem with anything else in the bill. I think this is a good bill as far as cleaning up some gray areas that I think we do need to clean up. But this is the one section where I'm not quite sure I understand why this exists. Why do I, as a legislator, need to use government resources to support my position with regards to a constitutional amendment? Whether I support or oppose that constitutional amendment, why should I have the ability to use government resources when the average public doesn't? Why should I get a benefit that the public doesn't get? And I think this clearly opens up the door for abuse, because I don't think there's any definition for reasonable. My definition of reasonable might be different than, for instance, the minority leader's definition of reasonable. And I don't know how, if in fact there is a question, how we enforce this. This is an ethics violation, so we have to go before the ethics committee, but it seems to me that we're opening a door that doesn't need to be opened, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, in Title 15, it clearly states, excuse me, not Title 15, Title 24 clearly states, and I'd like to read it if I could, Mr. Speaker. Subsection 5, use or authorize the use of state funds, facilities, equipment, services, or other government assets or resources for the purpose of political fundraising or campaigning is prohibited. But if we're worried that we have some kind of an existing ethics trap, for instance, let's say I'm in my office one day and a constituent calls and says, Andrew, you know, you got this constitutional amendment on the ballot. Can you explain it to me? And I'm put in kind of an awkward position. Title 24 covers that. In Section 8, says incidental efforts, for instance, answering questions, answering phone solicitations, we can do that. So currently there is a provision that allows us, if somebody calls us and engages us in how we stand or what our feelings are on a particular constitutional amendment, we can answer those without fear of violating ethics rules. So we, for all intents and purposes, are covered. This amendment takes this out of the bill. I think this is a fair amendment, because I don't think the public, Mr. Speaker, would appreciate me using government resources to advocate on behalf of a constitutional amendment, whether I support or oppose it. Now, you know, I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, I think most of the constitutional amendments that have passed this floor, at least last year when I was in this body, were highly debated. And I don't believe there was one constitutional amendment that was approved unanimously. So there's going to be people who oppose, support, and oppose the constitutional amendments that pass this body, pass out of this building, and are put onto the ballot. And I don't think that we should allow legislators or legislative staff to be involved in campaigning. There are plenty enough groups out there in the public that organize. Once something's put on the ballot, we've seen it a number of times, groups that get together and form create a group that has to register with the Public Offices Commission, because that clearly states that in Title 15, that if you're going to advocate on behalf of a ballot question, you have to register with APOC. I think that's fair. I think in a year that I think a couple of weeks ago we addressed a situation where there was a loophole, I think we're creating another loophole. We're allowing legislators and legislative staff to advocate and to campaign without registering with APOC. I think we're currently covering the statute's books. I mean, I certainly didn't have any constituents that called me last election cycle and asked me about any number of any one of the three constitutional amendments that we placed on the ballot. I didn't have anybody call me and ask me about that. So, Mr. Speaker, I'm not quite sure why this is put in here. This bill didn't come to any committees I sit on. But I think it certainly stuck out to me as something that is unnecessary and counterproductive to, I think, what the public would feel is a fair process. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I certainly understand the caution of the maker of the amendment. I guess I have a little different experience. I had a great many people contact me about ballot issues last session and express very strong concerns and ask for information. I would ask, the carrier of the bill plus the maker of the amendment that if my constituents are clearly, a vast majority of them are in support or in opposition of an proposition on the ballot, would it be proper in my role as their representative to try to represent their point of view, either in opposition or support? And I then also would further observe that reasonable is an interesting term and one that's probably subject to a variety of definitions. But as was pointed out, the final arbiter of this will be the Ethics Committee. And while we ought to write as concise legislation as possible, it's not likely we're going to be able to define reasonable to everyone's satisfaction. And I take some comfort in having served on the Ethics Committee that the Ethics Committee will do their usual superlative job in making a very careful decision on any questions of reasonableness that would come before them.
Representative Logan.
Have a brief at ease, please.
Brief at ease. Order. Further discussion of amendment number one, Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm rising in opposition to the amendment for a couple reasons. First of all, I want to point out to the body that during the rules hearing on this particular issue, we did have Susie Barnett on teleconference, and she confirmed that what we're doing here, there's already an opinion that has been expressed by the Ethics Committee saying this is okay. They've already given the concurrence that this is okay. So all we're doing here is putting this in statute. But beyond that, Mr. Speaker, if I were the sponsor of a constitutional amendment, worked on it, and my staff worked on it for 2 years, I think that individual sponsors should have some leeway in trying to convince the public that this is a good measure. If I were putting out a newsletter, and you can do that, you can use your office allowance account to do it, your staff could work on it, and in that body of the newsletter, I write about the constitutional amendment, and I urge everybody to vote for it because it's a good measure. This would allow for that to occur. I think you have to give the sponsor at least some liberty in taking the matter up and trying to coax members of the public or urge them to vote on behalf of the issue. Mr. Speaker, I think the reasonable versus unreasonable is somewhat problematic, but I believe that most of us are very intelligent individuals who would be able to make that determination. If you set up a phone bank in your office and were calling people, I would think that would be unreasonable. If you were sending out mass mailings on a day-to-day basis, cards or whatever, I believe that would be unreasonable. But, Mr. Speaker, I think the incidental and the phone calls and that you get from time to time where you can respond to your constituents and you can talk to them about it and your staff can talk to them about it and bring out the fine points in the resolution that's going before the voters, I think is the right thing to do, and I think we ought to give that individual sponsor of that initiative that opportunity. So I would vote, I'd urge members to vote against this amendment and put in statute what the Ethics Committee has already expressed in the form of an advisory opinion.
Representative Grubb. Representative James?
Mr. Speaker, made some comments about some of the previous comments that have been made, and certainly I hear a lot of questions about the constitutional amendments that are going to be on the ballot. And in an endeavor to explain to people both sides of the issue, if it happens to be that I personally work out of my home mostly in the summertime, so it's not a problem when I'm answering the phone at home. If I would be on the phone or returning phone calls at my legislative office, it would be a problem. And in many cases, the people call my office and my staff has to call me and tell me to call them. So my staff is doing that. And I'm not necessarily in all of those cases even advocating for or against a constitutional amendment, but simply by helping the people understand what the pros and cons are and how it affects. The amount of information that we get in the voter's pamphlet and the language that we have to use in a constitutional amendment is not usually very well understood. And so who else is going to be able to talk to the folks about what the discussion was when it went through this body? So I think we do have to have some, a little bit of leeway there to do that. Quite frankly, I think of the 40 members that is on this House floor and any new 40 members we have in the future are going to understand what reasonable is. We know by law that we're not supposed to utilize any of our government resources for these kinds of purposes, but you can't help it when you're on the phone or you're writing a letter or you're spending a little time responding to folks' concerns. And so, I don't think this is critical, this issue, but I think it is reasonable to put it in the statute.
Representative Davies and then Mr. Minority Leader.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise in support of the amendment. I think that we have the ability to use our resources to inform people about issues. We can send out a newsletter that clarifies issues tells people what the issue is about. What we can't do, and what we shouldn't do, in my opinion, is to send out a newsletter supporting or opposing an issue. And I don't know. I mean, why are we limiting this constitutional amendment? What's different about that in terms of us using government resources to campaign than any other issue? Somehow I guess people are thinking that's different. If I sponsor in representing the people of my district and I advocate down here for a constitutional amendment and then it gets on the ballot, I think then I want to campaign for that. I'm perfectly free to do that. I just have to go out and join a private group to do that. You can continue the campaign, but you just shouldn't ought to use government money to campaign. And we shouldn't ought to be putting it in the statutes that it's okay. Now I understand that there's a certain amount of incidental, making phone calls and things like that where people call you up and you got to respond. But the Ethics Committee has already dealt with that. There isn't a problem here. And I think we ought to keep the bright line in the statutes clear. That you shouldn't use public money to campaign with. You want to campaign? Fine. Every one of us is a citizen. We can go campaign. We've got to go raise the money like everybody else. Why should we use government money to advocate for or against an issue? Now, the incidental use issue, it's already dealt with, as the Rules Committee Chair indicated. The Ethics Committee has already dealt with the issue. We don't have a problem here. We don't need this. We've got to keep the line bright and clear. No government money into campaigns.
Mr. Minority Leader.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I always kind of love these softballs. They're just just sitting up there real big. So many things to talk about. Starting with what the majority leader said, though. She indicated that the 40 members here might know what reasonable is. But do the 20 members there know what reasonable is? I'm not confident in an affirmative response to that question, Mr. Speaker. I'd also like to take the body a little bit through the history of this particular section, at least as it came to this body. When this section came to this body, there was no adjective, or what is it, an adjective or an adverb, I can't remember. There's no modifier of use. It was just straight use of governmental resources was okay. But then the representative from Palmer inserted the term incidental as a modifier, because the conversation in judiciary was that he had some concern about unlimited use and of state resources. And then in judiciary, or in rules, reasonable was inserted. There should be a bright line. In a lot of ways, this amendment is about letting go. When resolutions addressing constitutional amendments are in the legislature, it is appropriate for us to be involved with them. That is part of our governmental function. But once we have voted on that resolution, we have to let go. It's no longer within the purview of this body or any individual member to campaign for or against on state money. There's a bright line. Once the resolution passes, we're done with it. It becomes public domain. It's not within the concern of the legislature. That line exists. I'd also point out that we're not limiting ourselves to campaigning, or this section doesn't limit itself to campaigning for state constitutional amendments, also federal constitutional amendments. We're opening a whole potential avenue of use of state funds, and I don't think we need to go there. I think the rule is real clear. Title 24 addresses what's acceptable. Incidental use is acceptable. The ethics opinions suggest incidental is okay. Someone calls you up, it's okay to respond to them. Mr. Speaker, the last point I want to make is the rules chair indicated that the ethics director suggested that this was this language was part of existing opinions, and I have a slightly different recollection. I recall that she took no opinion because this kind of statement is a policy statement that we can make. I don't recall her saying that this reasonable use was a current expression. I just have a slightly different recollection. So I would urge us to accept this amendment, and if we're going to tinker with the campaign reform, we ought to be very careful about where we go.
Representative Rookbert.
A couple points, Mr. Speaker. Prior two speakers are speaking of a bright line. Usually when we're lawmaking, we want to make it as clear as possible to people. But if we were to adopt this amendment, we're going to muddle it up. We're not going to make it any brighter. We're either going to default back to the opinion letter that either exists or doesn't exist, or we're going to end up in limbo land. If you want to make this bright, you either turn down this amendment or you change the word reasonable to no. That makes it a bright line. And, Mr. Speaker, I can think of a number of occasions where the legislature, this body, has a very legitimate interest in terms of advocacy when it comes to a constitutional amendment. The foremost being of any issues that revolves around separation of powers where we're trying to assert our rights. The one that really comes to mind and jumps up to me at me is the result of the Alive case a number of years ago where the state Supreme Court withdrew our ability to repeal regulations by a resolution, thereby avoiding a veto of the executive branch. And on three occasions, we've gone back to the voters to try to get their approval to reassert that power. But because of the ethics law and because of the lack to attract the outside group the member from the UAF talks about, those and the public hasn't been educated. We've those amendments have gone down to defeat. So I think there's a number of occasions where there's extraordinarily legitimate concern to have an advocacy position. And I think the other example is if you're a sponsor of an amendment, you should be able to advocate for it.
Representative Rockwood. Representative Croft.
Yeah, briefly, and in response to that, you know, we have to remember our proper role. We, in the constitutional amendment process, we propose, and the public then has the right to approve or turn down. We're used to having that power ourselves, both proposing and then voting on. But it's a different function here. That once we pass it, once we propose it, it's up to them. Now, as a prior speaker said, we're perfectly free like any other citizen. In fact, that's what we become, Mr. Speaker. Then we become any other citizen with every right to join a group, to advocate for it, to get on TV. The question we have here is, can we use the governmental resources they gave us to, in some cases, push our opinion back on them? I think it's inappropriate. I think then's the time for them to make up their mind. The time for our involvement has passed as an institution. Now, and in the prior case is the classic example. We keep thinking that it's a power we should have, the alive example of a power to change regulations without going through the entire process. The people keep disagreeing. And I don't think we should have the entire institutional power, the entire power of expenditure and using our staff and using our phones to convince them again of something they've told us three times they don't want. The point is, sometimes we use it for all the good, right policy reasons, but sometimes we're just trying to aggrandize our own power. Sometimes we get lost in that. And it's the appropriate check for the people to stop us, as they have three times in that example. And it's bordering on the offensive to me that we would use the power they gave us to write laws in this way. This is the time for them. We have every power of a citizen then, get on TV, and in fact more so because of our position, we're more likely to be put in line at a public event or put on the TV to talk about it. We just can't tell our staff, I don't care what you think about it, I'm directing you to go out and advocate for this. I'm directing you to start pushing this constitutional amendment I wrote. I'm directing you on state time, on the state dollar, with the money given me to conduct my business, to now go out and try and convince the public in what is, after all, a campaign.
Ben Gogan, and then McGuire, and then Cotillo.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Interesting debate today. Minority Leader is right. I did amend the bill in Judiciary to say incidental. And, you know, I agree with him. I agree with the Judiciary Chairman. And agreeing, always agreeing with my friends, I'm kind of torn between the two, because I think somewhere between the two, there's a balance. I'm not real comfortable with maybe some of the amendments I've voted against, having the people that, with the powers that be, that have all the money to go out and advocate for that. And I think, so I've been in the minority on some of the things that have passed out of this body and on occasion constitutionally. So, but I wonder if language like limited reasonable use, I mean, I know it's ambiguous, but at the same time, I think there is a role in us articulating to the public why we voted on stuff. Because I got a lot of calls, and not unlike the gentleman from Sand Lake, I got a lot of calls on the constitutional amendments, people asking me, what do you think? And I think it would have been good if I had the ability to put out, or the majority and the minority could put out information on the pros and cons and increase the public debate and awareness. Because I think most people don't really pay attention or have the access to the information or the time to really digest what the ramifications of a constitutional amendment are. So I think there is some appropriate role for the legislature to advocate. Is there a way that we can do it that's somewhat balanced, so both people on both sides of the aisle have the ability to advocate their position. I don't know. It's a sticky one. So I'm not sure how I'm voting on this, because I think there's merits in both arguments. And if somebody's got a way out of this, I think I'd like to hear about it, do an at-ease or huddle or whatever. Thanks.
Representative McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just wanted to rise to make a factual clarification. We had this bill in Rules Committee, and in particular, we spent a great deal of time on this subsection G. And I want to clarify to the members of the body, this is interesting how distorted it's all gotten. If we adopt this amendment right now, the only thing that happens is that the existing ruling by Susie Barnett et al. Is in effect. The existing ruling is actually slightly broader than this. And the debate that we had in Rules Committee was to try to come up with an effort at limiting that. We debated over the word incidental, we debated over the word reasonable, and arrived at reasonable. But my point here is that we've kind of gotten off track, and I just want to draw your attention to that. If we adopt this amendment, the only thing that happens is that this still exists, and it's just a little broader.
Representative McGuire. Representative Curtula.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like an at-ease, please.
Speaker, please. For the information of the body, there is some meeting of the minds, perhaps, on this issue, and it's going to take a little while to draft it. So since we have reached that time that we had discussed anyway, why don't we take a break, and we will return no later than 2:30. We will stand at ease. When we took an at-ease, we were addressing amendment number one. Representative Halcrow.
Mr. Speaker, I would move and ask unanimous consideration that I be allowed to withdraw amendment number one and replace it with new amendment number one.
Without objection, amendment number one has been withdrawn and been replaced with new amendment number one. Representative Halcrow.
Mr. Speaker, I would move new amendment number one.
There is objection. Representative Halcrow.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You know, there certainly has been some good debate on this issue, and I want to thank the representative from District 17 for pointing out something. And that is that, you know, certainly my intent is I had a concern about legislators or legislative employees using government resources to advocate for or against a specific constitutional amendment. I think that's inappropriate. But she pointed out that what happens is if we delete this entire section, then the only thing on record is the Ethics Committee opinion, which actually is broader than this. So by deleting this, we're actually opening the door wider. And I think really the intent, in the member from District 18 certainly brought up some good points about, you know, hey, what if you know, I get calls or people want to talk to me, as did the member from Palmer in my discussion with him during the at-ease. So what I did was I went back and we did a couple of things. One, we just deleted the word reasonable and put in incidental. And I think that's fair. I think if you get a call or you want to sit at your desk and write a speech to give to the Chamber of Commerce, you can do that. That's incidental use. But we deleted the part where they can utilize legislative employees to advocate for or against a constitutional amendment. And I think that is fair. I don't believe that I should be using my staff, whether I support or oppose a constitutional amendment, I don't believe I should be using my staff and government resources, which includes not only the time of the day while he's working, but government computers and phones and all that other stuff that's in the office. I don't believe that I should be able to utilize him or direct him in any way, shape, or form to carry on this work. What happens if my employee disagrees with me? What happens if my legislative employee doesn't support this constitutional amendment? I do, but yet I have the power to tell him, you have to go out and advocate for me. And I think You know, this is just one way to protect the public, and I don't understand why we wouldn't want to protect the public. I think we've had some good comments on this floor about where the bright line is, and certainly I think that this just tightens down the definition. It allows me as a legislator to respond, to receive calls in my office or respond to calls with regards to inquiries regarding these matters, but it prohibits me from utilizing my employee to advocate on my behalf for or against a constitutional amendment, and I think this simply just protects the public. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Alcro. Any further discussion? Representative Roberg and then Davies.
Mr. Speaker, on the new amendment number one, the page 9, line 28-29, by deleting that or legislative employee would allow potentially that legislative employee to solicit for funds. So I'd suggest that the maker of the amendment take another look at that.
Representative Davies?
I move to divide the amendment into page 9, line 26, and the following.
I would rule that the amendment is dividable. Lines 1, 2, and 3 would be new amendment 1A. Lines 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 would be B. Further discussion on new amendment 1A, deleting reasonable and replacing it with incidental. There's a call placed on the House. We can continue the debate during the satisfaction call. Representative Davies. Thank you, Representative Davies. We'll just wait until they're done. Jeanette? Over the House, please come back to order. Does every member have a copy of new amendment number one? Okay. Step one's okay. Now, step two, we have divided the question, and lines 1 through 3 are A of new amendment number one, and the rest of it is B. So, in the discussion of new amendment number 1A, are there any more comments? Representative Davies.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I support this part of the amendment because I think that would maintain what most of us thought the status quo was.
Representative Roper. Mr.
Speaker, I'd make an inquiry of the maker of the amendment that I understand from his original recitation that adopting the incidental language would be merely, I'm assuming now, be merely a recitation of existing law, and therefore be redundant, as I understood it.
Representative Cott?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm not, in response to the previous speaker's comment, I'm not sure that's entirely correct. I think the existing opinion is a little more broader than what's here before us in Amendment Number 1A. It's my recollection. Mr. Speaker, beyond that, I still oppose this. I just believe that by the adoption of this amendment, we would be restricting our ability to do what we're paid to do.
Representative Hogan and Nicotula.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just want to bring up the point that someone brought to me that my staff, actually, my most able-bodied staff, that that the governor routinely uses state assets and state travel and that kind of thing to go around and advocate for constitutional amendments. I know for a fact he does. And his employees do that on a regular basis in here, in the legislature and both out. And so know, that's something that I am struggling with, because this was originally my language that I, incidental, was put in here. And also, I'll bring up the point that Representative from Sand Lake pointed out to me, that incidentals are already covered in the statute. Thanks.
Representative Cajula.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I listened very hard, and that's why I asked for the at-ease to the representative from District 17 about, and I absolutely believed her. And if no objection, I'd like to read what the Ethics Advisory Opinion actually said about this.
Without objection.
Thank you. The question was, what activities may a legislator or legislative employee engage in to support or oppose a proposed amendment to the state constitution without violating the legislative code of ethics? The answer is, legislators or legislative employees may engage in activities in support of or opposition to a proposed amendment to the state constitution and may use state resources, including paid staff time, to support or oppose the amendment. However, state facilities and resources may not be used for activities related to contributions, and a legislative employee may not, on government time, solicit, accept, or receive contributions in support of or opposition to an amendment. And then we should contact APOC about campaign finance laws, about other legislative resources. So it appears to me that this amendment would indeed clarify that it was only incidental use that was proper, and I think that that it is a very good amendment. Thank you.
Representative Cajula. Any further discussion? Ready for the question? Question before the body is the adoption of Amendment 1A. Members may proceed to vote. Clerk, please lock the roll. Any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk.
22 yeas, 17 nays.
And so new amendment 1A passes the House. That brings before us a new amendment 1B. Any discussion? Ready for the question? Question before the body is the adoption of new amendment 1B. Members may proceed to vote. Will the clerk please lock the roll? Would any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk.
11 yeas, 28 nays.
So 1B has failed to pass the House. Be a reasonable response. Does the clerk have any other amendments?
Amendment number 2 by Representative James to page 2, lines 8 through 11.
Representative James.
I move amendment number 2.
There is objection, Representative James.
Mr. Speaker, to explain why I disagree with this language that's in this bill is, and want to take it away, is because the only reason why we require contributors to report when they give at least $500 to a candidate, and the candidate to also report the $500, is for confirmation that it has happened. This is a large sum of money, and so they want to be sure that in fact is that what is what they gave them, and there's also a date on it as to when they gave it, and so it's supposed to confirm from two sides that this contribution has been made. There's another, and so it seems to me unlikely that we ought to have the candidate do both of them, because it seems to me like it destroys the intent for having them do this. Further than that, if there's some reason with a contributor that they don't want to have to do this, or it's too much work for them, they can give $4.99 and they don't have to do it at all. So it seems to me like this is it just does away with the reason that we have this duplicate reporting, so that we can confirm that this actually happened.
Representative James, any other discussion? Representative Davies.
Mr. Speaker, I rise in opposition to the amendment, as I was the sponsor of the amendment that placed this in there. And, Mr. Speaker, it doesn't, having this in here does not change anything with respect to the responsibility for the person who made the donation to make sure that the report is made. So when if a candidate, and there's two sections to this. One refers to candidates, one refers to groups, and this we're only dealing with the candidate part. The reason why the group part is different is because groups, the amount can exceed 500. This is the maximum that a candidate can receive from someone. So, Mr. Speaker, the problem, the reason why I put this in there, frankly, is because, you know, my mother sent me a contribution, and I had to send her a form. She had to go get that from someplace, go back to the post office, and mail it back. And it just seems like in the cases where the candidate is willing to make the report, that we shouldn't require that back and forth process. The whole point of the campaign financing laws is disclosure. If the candidate makes the disclosure, has the information on the record, I don't know why we have to require that the person who made the donation also put it on the record. It's there. And so, however, the person who made the donation still has the responsibility. That's still in the statute. That the person who makes the contribution still has the ultimate responsibility. They have to assure themselves that the disclosure was made. This just allows a certain efficiency in allowing the campaign to make the disclosure and mail the copy of that to the person that made the contribution. So it's just trying to make the process a little more efficient.
Representative Davies.
Mr. Speaker, if I might respond to that, because, you know, I hear on this floor all the time all these little scenarios of how people can cheat. And certainly this would allow for cheating. Let's suppose that they didn't give them 500, they gave them another amount. And as long as the candidate has it the same on the other person's as their own, that could cover that up. I don't know that we even need it in here in the first place, but that's not the issue before us. And I just think that if there's a reason for the contributor to make the report, then there's no reason for the candidate to do it for them. Otherwise, they would just, why would you need two reports? So it totally, as far as I'm concerned, just does away with the, if there's a need in the first place, and I'm not questioning whether that's the issue, it's because not the one that's before us, there certainly is no reason for the candidate to do it for them. Now, in the case of the previous speaker, makes a lot of sense, assume his mom doesn't live in the state, and that she had to do this, and I assume that she talked to him about it before she sent him the money, and so I would assume that there would have been time for him to have sent her, say, Mom, if you're going to give me $500, you have to fill this out. It makes a lot of sense what he said, but in retrospect, it seems to me like it's not that burdensome. It's not only his mom giving him money, it's lots of other people giving lots of other people money, and it's not those folks that we're talking, it's those folks we're talking about.
Mr. Speaker, I stand in opposition to this amendment. These are the dreaded Form 15-5s. This is what a single $500 donation of in the form of a check, cash, and or goods or services in-kind donation. We are now limited to a single figure of $500. But over the years, I find this the most cumbersome and unwieldy reporting element that we've ever discovered here, and it has almost no efficacy in terms of policing, because I agree with the member from UAF for a change. it's extraordinary inconvenience. I'd like somebody to know, who's probably a better expert on the APOC law than I am, that we most recently raised the fines to an extraordinarily high level. And to punish somebody that, you know, I've received $500 checks out of the blue, and I have to make sure, geez, I wonder if this is the right campaign, you know, until I realize, well, this came from somebody, and or from people that were totally unaware of our APOC statutes. They do not realize that they have a requirement under our law to fill out that 15-5 and send it in. So unless I, as a candidate, send them the form with the prepaid envelope with a stamp on it and check here and fill the thing out, which I do for every one of these people, I'm afraid that they could be subject to fine. But it's almost, as the member from UAF says, it's rather ludicrous because it's a double step. Just so the APOC has the report and has the additional periodic report during the course of the campaign, that should be an adequate check. And quite frankly, Mr. Speaker, I think that this is another incumbent act. We all know how this works if you've been around a while. But people that are going to be newcomers to running for office, they don't understand it. They probably don't know what the fines are. And I wish I could recall right now. They really are quite large. We raised them up. And I can't abide this amendment.
Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just a point of clarification. I believe the previous speaker indicated that the 15-5 report would be required any time we've received $500 in check cash for the services. We can't receive cash up to $500. I believe the limit's $100.
Any other discussion? Ready for the question? Question before the body is the passage of Amendment Number 2. Members may proceed to vote. Will the clerk please lock the roll? Any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk.
7 yeas, 29 nays.
So Amendment Number 2 has failed to pass the House. Does the clerk have any other amendments?
I have no further amendments.
Madam Majority Leader.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the House, I'll start over. Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that House CS for SB 103 rules as amended be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
There is objection. This bill will appear in third reading on tomorrow's calendar. Please retain your copies of the bill. Would the clerk please read the next item?
House Bill 52, entitled An Act Relating to the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision and the State Council for Interstate Adult Offender Supervision, amending Rules 4 and 24, Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure, and providing for an effective date. We're in third reading.
Representative Hogan.
Mr. Speaker, I move that we go back into second reading for the purposes of a specific amendment, that being Amendment Number 1.
Without objection, we're in second reading for consideration. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Rookberg?
Can I have a brief of these?
Brief of these. Hearing no objection, we are in second reading for the purposes of consideration of.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Move Amendment Number 1.
There is objection. Representative Hogan.
Mr. Speaker, Article 3, Section 26, under Boards and Commissions, says, if I may have to leave the body to read a very short section.
No objection.
When a board or commission is at the head of a principal department or a regulatory or quasi-judicial agency, then they I'll paraphrase, they need to be subject to confirmation. Mr. Speaker, I would advocate that this director or this person that the governor appoints in this section of the bill is a principal of a regulatory and quasi-judicial agency. This agency has the ability, although it's a national compact, has the ability literally to pass rules that have the force of law in our state. And I think that's a very, personally, I think it's a very troubling and disturbing thing, and we'll get into that in the next amendment. But if we're going to have this, I think the legislature should at least have a say in this person that will have a vote of this quasi-legislative power almost, that this compact that has the ability to make rules that have the force of law and can be adjudicated in our state. I think it's very important that we, as a legislature, confirm that person. Thank you very much.
Representative Rookberg.
Mr. Speaker, this individual will be a designee of the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, basically an employee representing the Department of Corrections and the state in the compact. It's not an appointment of the governor. It's not a standard type appointment. It's not a board or commission or something like that. So I don't think this is appropriate to have a review by the legislature.
Representative Brooklyn. Representative Davies.
Getting out here on thin ice a little bit, I believe also that the legislature has to adopt these rules. I think it would be unconstitutional for us to adopt a set of rules that could change in the future. And if that's what we're doing, we need to make sure that we readopt them whenever they change.
Representative Croft.
Yeah, I think we're all on a little bit of thin ice. This is a big bill that possibly not all of us read in detail. I know I didn't, but I'm wondering really whether it the section of the Constitution that we're talking about, Section 26 of Article 3, the Executive. Can I read a brief passage? The constitutional authority on appointments. When a board or commission is at the head of a principal department or a regulatory or quasi-judicial agency, its members shall be. And before that, Section 25, department heads of principal departments, when appointed by the governor, subject to confirmation. I'm wondering whether it should be the contract administrator, which just seems another executive office administrator, or below that, 33-36-140, which is the state council, and has two members appointed by the governor from citizens, maybe others, I'm just reading it, but at least two members appointed there. And it would seem, if we're going to do one or the other, and I don't know whether we should do both or neither, but if we're going to do one or the other, it probably should be the appointees to the council from the governor that we confirm rather than the administrator.
Croft. Further discussion? Representative Bogan,
and wrap up, Mr. Speaker. Section 3 says the governor shall appoint the administrator. And again, I want to emphasize what kind of powers this administrator and this compact will have. This compact will have lawmaking authority in the state of Alaska, but they aren't an elected representative of the state. They're appointed by the governor, and they're going to serve on this compact. And the rules of this compact have the force of law in our state. And that by itself troubles me. If we look back on page 19, on page 19, line 20, all compact, if I may read that one sentence.
Without objection.
All compacting states' laws conflicting with this compact are superseded to the extent of the conflict. So here we are, we're appointing this person that's going to have the power to supersede state laws, and they aren't an elected official. I have some serious constitutional problems with that. But if we're going to go there, then I think we should at least have the legislature scrutinize them and confirm them. Thank you.
Representative Croft.
Thanks for doing it twice, but we are getting into new areas, and we may be getting beyond this amendment, and it may be proper under the other amendment, but that in wrap-up citing that section, it doesn't say that the administrator has the power to make laws or even regulations. It says you're adopting this compact and all the provisions of this compact. You need that in a compact. If everyone's going to have a uniform thing, then there has to be some assurance that you haven't got some other, they can't research every part of your law, so they've got to know that compact as it's written works and that it supersedes the other parts of your law that might be in conflict with it. What they mean is this document that we can read and adopt and look at, that this document supersedes anything else, not that the administrator can supersede any other law that they want. And like I said, if I were writing a compact that 50 states were going to sign, I would need to know that they were all legal and that this all worked. Either I'd need to be an expert in all 50 states' laws and assure myself that nothing in their laws conflicted with this compact, or I'd put in a provision on each one of these that says, and this is what it means. All of this is in effect, and to the extent you have other laws somewhere else that I don't know about, they're superseded. Now, I'm looking forward to the discussion on the next amendment, because I will have a lot of trouble with this if they have the power to supersede laws by their actions to enact laws or regulations. I haven't seen that yet. and it's not particularly germane to Amendment Number 1, but await that discussion. Amendment Number 1, I think we're confirming the wrong person. I don't think we should confirm the administrator. Maybe there's a good argument we confirm the council, however.
Representative Davies and then Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, I think I agree with everything the prior representative said except for one, which is that the issue is not germane to this one. If, in fact, this set of this compact can be changed by this group without us readopting those changes, then I would agree to this amendment. But I don't believe it does, and we'll get to that in the next amendment. So putting on the record right now that I don't believe that it does, then I'm opposed to this amendment because I don't think it's necessary, given that we are adopting the law here, and any future changes we have to adopt then.
Thank you very much. Just to be specific here, apparently the maker of the amendment made the amendment thinking that because the compact administrator had some kind of regulatory role, he or she would be subject to confirmation. But I just want to read from page 20 what the compact administrator will do, and it clearly is not regulatory. The compact administrator is responsible for the administration and management of the state supervision and transfer of offenders. It's not regulatory. They're not promulgating regulations.
Further discussion? Ready for the question? Question before the body is the adoption under HB 52 of Amendment Number 1. Members may proceed to vote. Would the clerk please lock the roll? Would any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk?
5 yeas, 34 nays.
Amendment Number 1 fails to pass the House. Representative Coghill.
I think I'm a little faster than representative from behind me here. Also, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to...
Brief at ease. Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to move that we go back to second reading on this bill for the purpose of another specific amendment.
Motion for the body is to go back to second for the consideration of Amendment Number 2 on the member's desk. Without objection, we are in second reading for the consideration of Amendment Number 2. Representative Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And this amendment brings
us... We need to move...
Oh, I move the amendment, Mr. Speaker.
There is objection. Representative Coghill.
I believe that this compact gets us off into some territory where the rulemaking authority of the compact could overrule the state statute. And before we ratify a compact such as this, I think it should be the purview of this body. So before this amendment would simply have them come before us on an annual basis, and the key words in these would be on line 7, during the previous calendar year, the legislature shall review the rules to determine if the compact should be repealed, amended, or permitted to continue. And I think it should be the purview of this body, since statutory authority is really going to be a major question.
Representative Cotullo.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We had a similar issue just before us in a bill that a number of us have been spending an inordinate amount of time on recently, and about delegation of authority to some other entity, an agency, rulemaking body, and in particular about what happens if the state tries to adopt rules that are in the future that aren't even made yet. And we talked quite a bit about it yesterday in the Finance Committee, and the bottom line is we can't legally adopt something, we don't believe, that isn't even in existence yet, but it's not what we're talking about here, and carefully looked through the bill for that, and it's very clear that what we're adopting is contained right before us in terms of what the compact is, and that the bill itself states clearly that nothing will go into effect unless that's a change, no future change goes into effect unless it's enacted into law by unanimous consent of the compacting states. So we have that second shot at it. So I believe that that's covered and that we don't have a delegation of authority problem. If the members would like, I can read the section of the bill that...
Without objection.
Just real quickly, on page 16, it's lines 18 through 22. Amendments to the compact may be proposed by the Interstate Commission for enactment by the compacting states. No amendment shall become effective and binding upon the Interstate Commission and the compacting states unless and until it is enacted into law by unanimous consent of the compacting states. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Cutillo. Representative James?
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm happy that we got that message from the just previous speaker, because from my understanding of what a compact is let's make a deal. And if you have someone else that has to behind you that has to support the deal, and then you go off with the deal, of course you can't change the deal until everybody goes back to the folks who gave them the authority to make the deal in the first place. So the language that was read there is understood to me. If you're going to support a compact, and here it is all lined out, there's no way anybody can change that without coming back and asking you if it's okay. So I think that this is superfluous, and I don't believe that we need to do this because I think it's already inherent in the law.
Thank you, Representative James. Representative Hogan?
Mr. Speaker, I'll be reluctantly supporting the amendment because I don't think it goes far enough. It's better than what I would like to see, or it's not as good as what I'd like to see. But I'd bring to your attention I think it's germane to the amendment discussion, that in a legal opinion I had done today by Jerry Luckup, who said that it's dubious constitutionality at best. And that appears that, if I might read a sentence.
Jack.
All right, I'll paraphrase it. It appears provisions may amount to an unconstitutional delegation. Unconstitutional delegation of authority. And he cites the Northern Lights case, and the Alaska Supreme Court talked about how people don't have the ability to comment on or object to or put their input in on what this compact, or what in this Northern Lights case happened, but what they wouldn't have the opportunity to comment or have any process, any due process in what would have the force of law on the state. Now, I think what this bill does is laudable. I think it's a great, I know what they're trying to do. I'm not against what the bill's trying to do. What I'm against is, and what I think this amendment tries to address is this delegation of power, and it tries to give the legislature the ability to take a look at it. So I guess I'm going to vote for the amendment. I don't think it goes far enough, and we'll discuss the rest of the stuff when we get on the bill. Thanks.
Any further discussion? Representative Coghill, and wrap up.
And just an appreciation for the representative from Juneau pointing out, but there's a balance in the issue, and I think that needs to be made. And if you look on page 19, line 18, you'll see that once again, the compact has the trumping power. Even though we all be on the discussion, I think that there could be some real legal tangles here, and it should be something that we review on an annual basis. Even though they are going to be coming back to us, I think it could be sidestepping a very important part of the discussion. So I would really appreciate the amendment being passed as a safeguard to make sure that we're not getting out into deep water here.
Representative Whitaker? Brief it easy. Representative Croft and Curtula, please address the C comes before K.
Seniority, too. You know, there are two issues that are interrelated. One is the clean adoption of a compact, if you will, that this is the compact, a deal is a deal, to paraphrase the majority leader, and that it supersedes any other provisional law, so you can know what it is and everyone can be confident, and then any amendments to it do have to be ratified by us, adopted by us, really. It's part of the law, and no amendment to the compact itself is adopted without all the consent of the parties, as she stated. But there is a troubling kernel of a problem. The rules that they adopt, that this commission adopts, regulations and rules, really, are binding and do supersede. And we're assured in discussions at the at-ease that those rules are purely technical, and I believe that's probably the case, that they relate to the forms you have to fill out and the timing, and you must notify me in 10 days before a prisoner is transferred up, all that. I'm willing even to take that at face value. But I think at the minimum, we ought to adopt Amendment Number 2. And I told the maker of the amendment that it might hurt him having me stand up and support his amendment. He could lose some votes that way. But I do think at the very least that we get the information. What rules have you adopted in the last year? We can look at them and say, these look to be technical, and maybe after a couple of years we just are comfortable with how it's going. Or, no, these seems to have a substantive impact, and we either want to amend the compact and say, you must bring them to us first, or at the most drastic, I guess, get out of the compact or change its structure materially. But I do think Amendment Number 2 is a good safeguard so that we see them and we can look at them.
Representative Cotulla.
I agree. Thank you.
Representative Davies.
Resist a minor wordsmithing here, though. On line 6, after provide, I would suggest that we insert a report on. So I move that as an amendment.
Is there objection to an amendment to the amendment on line 6 after provide, adding the words? One more time, Representative Davies.
A report on.
A report on. Is there objection? Hearing no objection, the amendment to the amendment is adopted. Back to the amendment. Is there further discussion? Ready for the question? The question for the body is the adoption of Amendment Number 2 as amended. Members may proceed to vote. Would the clerk please lock the roll? Representative Moses? Would the clerk please lock the roll? Would any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk.
37 yeas, 1 nay.
And so, Amendment Number 2 has passed the House. That brings the bill back before us in third reading. Is there any discussion of HB 52? Representative Ogun. Representative Rookberg is carrying the bill.
I get to talk. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This is Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. This compact governs the state-to-state transfer and supervision of parolees and prohibitioners. Prohibitioners. Probation of alcohol on the brain. Probationers. This is a reciprocal agreement among the states to exchange parolees and probationers and continued their needed supervision. Mr. Speaker, this particular compact would replace one that's been in effect since 1937. We're having all this fuss today about modernizing a compact that is way overdue to be updated and brought into conformance. This particular compact will go into effect upon the ratification of 34 other states. 19 states have already adopted this. It's very important that that offenders who travel across state lines are overseen by thousands of different local parole and probation officers who operate within hundreds of different agencies. This fragmented system makes it very difficult to account for all the offenders, since there is no national system to track the movement of offenders across state line. This restructuring provides more oversight for both state and national levels. It holds states and offenders more accountable and facilitates communication between the states, promoting effective public safety. This creates a very effective management system and the level of cooperation needed to provide for, if you will, the interstate travel of those people under supervision. This is a public safety issue. Unfortunately, I can appreciate and I respect the concerns expressed today by some of our stalwarts of our Constitution. That's an important factor, and it's worthy of debate. But unfortunately, we're in a situation that, in fact, we want to participate in the national compact. We're almost in a take-it-or-leave-it situation. I would point out that, albeit the rules to be adopted by this new compact have not been promulgated. I think it's important that we adopt this legislation now so the contract administrator, those designated to attend to the development of these rules, are there to protect our interest at the outset. If we delay an adoption of this, we can't protect ourselves as well. Also, I believe that with the adoption of Amendment Number 2, we've certainly satisfied a lot of the concerns expressed here today that there should be adequate legislative oversight. And moreover, Mr. Speaker, anything that involved in those rules that is unconstitutional under our Constitution, that trumps it. Our Constitution is protected if that is the conflict of law. So I'd ask that you, as members of this body, update our relationship with our other sister states to be able to supervise these people for the public safety of all of us. Thank you.
Representative Rookberg. Representative Hogan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a little bit of a warm, fuzzy feeling, not about the delegation of power, but at least at the level of consciousness of what we're doing here has been raised, and I appreciate the members' support for the last amendment. Mr. Speaker, the Constitution is pretty clear how bills become law. They have to have three readings. The power to make laws delegated to the legislature from the Constitution. And Mr. Speaker, I'm concerned that over time, the sovereignty of the states continues to be eroded by various factions of and actions of the U.S. Congress and these kind of compacts. And I'm not speaking against the bill in particular, except the section that we've been discussing. I think the bill in itself is a good idea, and the motives behind it are a good thing. But that's how the powers of the states get eroded. These good ideas and these good things. And some governments end up being tyrannical when they get too much power. And it just doesn't sit right with me to have an unelected official, a member of some well-meaning compact, telling the state that, or a group of officials telling us that what they say becomes law in our state because they aren't elected representatives. And that's going to be the source of my no vote. It's not because this is a bad thing or that the people that are going to be overseeing this are bad people. It's just that I think it's a trend that's happening in our country that we really need to be cognizant of and be worried about as state legislators and as sovereigns in this nation. Thank you.
Representative Hogan. Any further discussion? Ready for the question? Question before the body. Shall HB 52 pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Would the clerk please lock the roll? Representative Halcrow. Now, would the clerk please lock the roll? Any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk.
35 yeas, 4 nays.
So, HB 52, as amended in the House, has passed the House. Madam Majority Leader.
Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call on the bill be considered the roll call vote on the court rule change amending Rule 4 and 24 Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure.
Without objection, the court rule change is adopted. Madam Majority Leader.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call on the bill be considered the roll call vote on the effective date clause.
Without objection, the effective date clause is also adopted. Would the clerk please read the next item on today's calendar?
CS for Senate Joint Resolution 15 rules by the Senate Rules Committee relating to imports of salmon from Chile. The House Special Committee on Fisheries considered the resolution recommending due pass Dyson, Coghill, Scalzi, Kapsner, Curtula, Wilson, Stevens. The report was signed by Wilson and Stevens co-chairs. I have no amendments on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Madam Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the CS for SJR 15 rules be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Without objection, we are in third reading. Would the clerk please read the title for the third and final time?
CS for Senate Joint Resolution 15 rules relating to imports of salmon from Chile.
Discussion. Representative Stevens.
Mr. Speaker, after all of the argumentation and contentiousness of the day, it's a pleasure to present to you an issue which I think is almost a motherhood issue in the state of Alaska, and certainly one that this legislature has historically supported ever since from our territorial days. Mr. Speaker, the current situation is extremely bleak in the Alaska seafood industry. We have seen a 270% increase in Chilean imports from 1996 to 99. In that three-year period, a 270% increase from 12,000 metric tons to 33,000 metric tons. Chile has now 90% of the United States market for fresh salmon fillets. It makes it very difficult for Alaska fishermen, very difficult for them to break into this domestic market because of the influx of these cheap Chilean products and because they are so readily available. It would be easier if Alaskans could compete if the industry, our industry, was not starting off at a disadvantage to the competition. Just to let you know, there are two major areas in which we are at a serious competition. One is in the cost to Alaska fishermen. The other is in the indirect subsidies to the Chilean industry. In the for the Alaska fishermen, the Alaska fishermen have to deal with sustained yield management, with the DEC permits, with Coast Guard standards, with enhancement taxes, with business taxes, with seafood marketing taxes, with insurance requirements, and, of course, with higher crew pay. On the other hand, we're facing real problems with the Chilean imported fish in that there is very little environmental control, very little environmental demands and regulations in Chile. For example, there's been an escapement of over 4 million fish into the environment. They extensively use antibiotics to help with parasite and disease outbreaks. There is a serious over-medication which results in immunity, and there's also all these chemicals are being entered into the environment. And also there's a tremendous use of diseased fish as fish meal in order to cut down on feeding costs. Another element of why we are at an unfair advantage, a disadvantage with Chile, has to do with the cheap labor. A farm worker in Chile is paid $250 a month. No overtime, no unions. And just as a side note, there was a recent article in the newspaper indicating that the president of Chile, President Lagos, was on a vacation at a lake in southern Chile, and the article reported that he couldn't go swimming because of the pollution from the local fish farms. So, Mr. Speaker, I realize the United States has a great deal to gain through the free trade agreement with Chile in many ways, but clearly Alaska's salmon fishermen, Alaska's salmon industry will also lose. Hoping we can open our markets even further, that is a serious problem. If we open our markets even further to Chilean salmon, it'll make it harder for us to market our fish on the domestic market. So this resolution, Mr. Speaker, sends a message to the United States government to ensure that our concerns here in Alaska are heard, and hopefully that our trade representative understands this and understands that this Alaska state legislature has always and will continue to support our salmon fishing industry. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Stevens. Representative Wilson, Foster, and Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 15 years ago, wild salmon from Alaska dominated the world salmon markets. Today, in contrast, the total 1999 Alaskan salmon harvest was 898.6 million round pounds, and world salmon farms produced 1.8 billion round pounds. Alaskans need to go on record opposing the unrestricted importation of Chilean pen-raised salmon. Chile is now the world's leader in farmed salmon production, and there is enormous potential to continue this growth. The Chilean salmon industry operates without the concerns and expenses of environmental protections. It is subsidized by the government and uses cheap labor. All of these factors make for a very uneven playing field for Alaskans. By contrast, Alaskan salmon is harvested by independent fishermen and processed in plants that operate in remote Alaskan communities. Environmental concerns and EPA regulations add to the Alaskan production costs, and transportation from remote Alaskan sites is very expensive. All these costs add up against Alaska salmon and favor cheap Chilean imports. Wild salmon is the primary product of most fishing ports in Alaska, including those that I represent. I strongly support this resolution and ask that you all favor it.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Mulder?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I intend to support this amendment, but, Mr. Speaker, while I'm sympathetic to the arguments that are put forward by my friends from the commercial fishing industry, on the other hand, Mr. Speaker, I could call this the let's stick our head in the sand and pretend we don't have a competition problem resolution, because we do. Mr. Speaker, I don't care what kind of resolutions we pass. The fact is there's competition out there in the free marketplace for salmon. It's happening. You know, the commercial fishing industry, several years ago, I offered a bill to open up, to allow for restricted fish farming in Alaska for the economic benefits. So commercial fishermen could participate in it and compete on a year-round basis. They chose not to do that, Mr. Speaker. They didn't think they had a problem then, and at times I think, Mr. Speaker, they deny they have a problem today. Mr. Speaker, that's far from the truth. We all know it. The world market has so dramatically shifted, we have now just a relatively small slice of the world market. And I don't mean to antagonize my friends who represent the commercial fishing industry, but this problem can be addressed meaningfully, working with the industry to try and open up some year-round, sustainable salmon hatcheries, salmon fisheries, salmon farming in Alaska in a controlled environment that will allow these individuals to compete on a year-round basis.
Representative Mulder. Representative Hogan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to associate myself with the comments from the previous speaker and also bring to mind the, I believe it was called the Summit of Americas, of the Americas or something like that was in Canada here a week or two ago where all the riots were going on. And if you look at that, what's going to happen if NAFTA and GATT are ratified throughout North America and South America, Chile will be an unfettered competitor of Alaska salmon. And it's not a very warm, fuzzy thought for Alaska fishermen. But I guess I make the analogy, we used to export 100% of, used to have a corner on 100% of the LNG market in the Pacific Rim. Now we export about 2%. I think commercial fish needs to wake up to that fact that this train's coming, and our resolution, while I'll support it, probably isn't going to have much of an effect, and maybe should, it gets into the other body, maybe should address that summit of the American issue. Thank you.
Senator Scalzi, and then Curtula, and then we'll wait to wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wasn't prepared to speak on this because I thought it pretty much had unanimous support. I do want to reference a couple of comments. My friend from Muldoon certainly didn't want to antagonize the commercial fishing industry, and I appreciate that. But we're coming close. This resolution is certainly a statement. It's not a bill. But I'll tell you, any discussion that has to do with fish farming is very, very extensive. We all know the issues of environmental concerns. We all know the issues of, I could speak at length of what's happened over in Norway and Scotland about the subsidies that those governments have put themselves through with the banks over there, because it did not work. It did not work without government help, and Chile will not work without government help. We pride ourselves in Alaska as being self-sufficient, self-reliant. Our commercial fishing industry certainly is. And to mix it up, I just want to clarify, to mix the issue up here is not in the best interest of everyone. I think that the issue as stands as it is in this resolution speaks for itself. Thank you.
Representative Scalzi. Representative Cotullo.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We were fortunate to hear this resolution in the Fish Special Committee, and one of the interesting things that was spoken about from the representative from District 25 spoke about the fact that in Chile there's evidence that entire estuaries are dead from fish feces, and that there are definitely problems that we received information on concerning the use of antibiotics in these farmed fish. So, you know, growing up on a farm and growing up in a family that valued organic foods and safe foods, it's really disturbing to see some of the diseases spreading throughout animals and then fish. So I'm really highly supportive of this resolution and think it sends a very good message. Also, just a small point, but that is that Chile is not part of NAFTA, so they aren't even under the requirement to follow their own environmental laws. So it's a really good resolution. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
And in wrap-up, Representative Stevens.
Mr. Speaker, I feel I need to respond to a couple of comments that have been made. You know, I think we did the right thing. When we took the high road, we stayed with the natural wild salmon. When we said this is a unique resource which we need to protect, and in the long run, that will be the more valuable resource. There are certainly a lot of problems with farm salmon. Even in British Columbia today, we're finding problems that I spoke of, that the same problems they're facing in Chile, and problems with escapement, problems with antibiotics, problems with overuse of antibiotics, problems of using diseased fish as fish meal. All of those problems exist whenever there are farm salmon, and even in British Columbia. Furthermore, I'd like to say that Washington and Maine, the states of Washington and Maine, also allow salmon farming, and they are also suffering from the Chilean imports. It's not just Alaska with our wild salmon. It's also the farm salmon that are being produced in other states like Maine and Washington. They have a tremendous disadvantage trying to compete with Chile because of the low labor costs and the low standards, the environmental standards that are so very low. So even if we had allowed salmon farming in Alaska, even if we had allowed that, we would still be hurt by this Chilean industry. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Stevens. Any further discussion? Ready for the question? Question before the body is the adoption of committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 15 rules. Members may proceed to vote. Would the clerk please lock the roll? Any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk.
38 yeas, 1 nay.
And so committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 15 rules has passed the House. Would the clerk please read the next item.
CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 17, State Affairs, relating to requesting that President Bush renounce and reverse Clinton administration anti-gun ownership policies and reorient the United States Department of Justice towards policies that accurately reflect the intent of the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution to grant individual Americans the right to keep and bear arms. We're in third reading.
Discussion. Question? Ready for the question? Question before the body. Shall committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 17, State Affairs? Pass the House. Members may proceed to vote. Would the clerk please lock the roll? Would any member wish to change his or her vote? Madam Clerk.
35 yeas, 2 nays.
The committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 17, State Affairs, has passed the House.
Extra close to reconsideration of my vote on
SJR 17. Reconsideration to be given on SJR 17. Would the clerk please read the next item?
House Bill 234 by the House Finance Committee, entitled An Act Relating to the Financing of Construction and Renovation of Certain Public Facilities and Providing for an Effective Date. The Finance Committee considered the bill, recommending it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 234 Finance with the new title, recommending do pass Whitaker, Harris, Lancaster, Hudson, Foster, Mulder, Williams, no recommendation Moses, amend Croft and Davies, A fiscal note was attached. The report was signed by Mulder and Williams, co-chairs. I have one committee substitute, Mr. Speaker.
Briefities.
Your order. Before the addies, we were ready to adopt a committee substitute. Madam Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the Finance Committee substitute for House Bill 234 with a new title be adopted in lieu of the original bill.
Without objection, we have the Finance Committee substitute before us. Do we have amendments?
Amendment number one by Representatives Croft and Jewell, beginning page 5, line 21.
Representative Croft? There is objection. Representative Croft.
Hearing objection, Mr. Speaker. I think I heard it. This would make the 40. Obviously, what we're doing in this bill is taking. We took 40% last year. Now we're taking another 40% of our tobacco securitization, and that generates about $127 million. Amendment number one would use that money exclusively for building schools, rather than in the bill now a combination of University of Alaska projects and ports and harbors